This is the 2010 West Coast Daughters of Sarah. The theme for the weekend, the spiritual habits of a sister in Christ. Our study leader this weekend is Brother Roger Lewis. This is session 10, entitled How to Set Effective Personal Spiritual Goals. Brother Roger.
Right, are you all paying attention? Now we get to the serious bit. It's all very well to study characters in the Bible, but at some stage we've got to get this down in terms of where we're going ourselves. So what I'm going to do in this next study, which you might find a bit unusual because it's not biblical in a sense, in terms of the fact that we're not going to trace through a scriptural theme, but for all of that, I think it's a biblical idea. We're going to talk about how to set goals in life, personally. And I'm going to try and stretch your thinking, perhaps push you a little, on purpose, because I think the time has come. So I just want to start by talking about this idea here, which is known as locus of control. I don't know whether you've ever heard about that phrase before, but locus of control is something used to describe whether one has an internal or external locus of control as a perspective for life. And how it works is this, just as a brief summary, is that individuals with a high internal locus of control believe that events result primarily from their own behaviour and their own actions. So many people with a strong internal locus of control have in fact grown up in families which emphasised effort and self-discipline and supported responsibility in thinking. And as a result of that, they grow up with a strong internal locus of control. It's up to me. I've got a personal responsibility to take charge of my life and do something with it. And we wouldn't altogether disagree with that, would we? In fact, we'd say that in large measure that's true and right. There are other people, however, that have grown up with a strong external locus of control. And people with a high external locus of control believe that powerful others or fate or chance primarily determine the events of life. Many externals have grown up in families which shift responsibility to others and attribute success or failure to unknown causes. So perhaps for many of us, whether we have a strongly developed internal or external locus of control, in the first instance may be the legacy of our family upbringing. If I can give you an illustration, we know of a family who are on welfare benefits. But not only are the children on welfare benefits, so also are the parents, and so were the grandparents, and so were the great-grandparents. Four generations of welfare dependency syndrome. Guess what got talked about at the kitchen table? And the answer was, what else you can get out of the system? How the system owes us a living. Why, if we don't get a good job, it's the system's fault and not us. People that grow up with a strong external locus of control are very quick to want to blame other factors as to why life hasn't worked out very well. That there are other things beyond their control. Now, the interesting thing is that for Christadelphians, we actually believe in a balance, don't we? Because we believe in personal responsibility and effort, but we're mindful of the fact that our lives are subject to the sovereign and providential hand of the Father in our lives. So in fact, Christadelphians are aware of both sides of the ledger, as it were. And yet over and over again in the Bible, what we will find is examples of men and women who, although aware of God's sovereign direction of their life, prayed to him, made a commitment, and then got stuck into what they had decided to do in the matter of faith and with prayer that God would answer them in what they had done. It was a combination of the two. Now, why that idea of locus of control is important, because what I'm going to talk about this morning in terms of goal setting is perhaps predicated on the idea that we have a properly developed internal locus of control. Because it would be true, isn't it, that even in the truth we'd be wrong to say, well, it's all in God's hands, so I don't need to do anything. That wouldn't be right, would it, in the truth? We wouldn't want to say that it's fate or destiny based on God's sole prerogative whether we'll be in the kingdom or not, and so since he already knows, there's no point in us trying to do anything because he already knows anyway. That would be wrong to think and act that way. The Father has called us that we might manifest him, and he wants us in the kingdom, but he also needs us to develop the character that's well-pleasing in our present mortal life. We've got to have some focus of direction in order to accomplish that. The second thing I wanted to mention, just before I move on to the matter of goals, is the matter of time perspective. There's been a number of interesting studies done on time and the perspective of time in people's lives. We become what we think about most of the time is a well-known dictum with time management experts. We become what we think about most of the time. Does that sort of like have the ring of truth to it? Even in the truth, that's right, isn't it? We become what we think about most of the time. In the end, the tree is known by his fruits. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, says the scriptures. So here it is about time, you see. To focus on the past is to regress. To focus on the present is to exist. To focus on the future is to develop. But future focus is only possible when we've understood our personal values and clarified our personal goals. Now, I think it's true for many of us that life can get so busy that if we're not careful, our time perspective is very much, so much the present that all we're doing is existing day by day. We're just existing day by day, getting through the circumstances of life. But we've got no sense of direction, no sense of growth, no sense of development, no sense of challenge. And there are some who spend the rest of their lives blaming everyone for what's happened in their past. And you'll hear 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds still blaming their parents for whatever went wrong when they were children. That's not helpful, is it? In the end, at some stage in a person's life, they've got to say, well, whether mum and dad did the right thing or the wrong thing, because by the time they become mothers and fathers themselves, they'll realise that they also will make mistakes in their parenting, and probably their parents would gladly confess that they didn't do everything perfectly. None of us do. But at some stage, a child reaches the point of maturity where they've got to accept responsibility for their own life and move on. You can't live in the past. That is to regress. So really, those that are focused on the kingdom, strangely enough, because this particular slide is not based on the truth. This is a set of principles that come out of, well, they come from a time expert, unrelated to the truth. And yet the comment is that those that are future-focused tend to develop. So here's the key. What they have discovered is that successful people typically display three characteristics. Now, of course, the big question mark is, what's success? But just bide your time for a moment. Even taking the world's definition, but overlaying it with the truth, you'll find it makes sense. Successful people display three characteristics. The first is that they are future-focused. The second is that they are action-orientated, and the third is that they are solutions-driven. They don't see problems. They see opportunities. It's a famous story about Napoleon, who once faced one of the biggest battles of his life in a place called Austerlitz. I've walked on the field where the battle took place. Napoleon had a little army, not nearly big enough to face the armies that had brought against him of three other nations who collaborated together to outflank, outmaneuver, outthink, outgun, and finally outbattle Napoleon on this occasion. He couldn't possibly win. His army was just physically too small. I think they were either double or triple his size. And you know how they used to fight in those days? Quite strange, really. It was all quite gentlemanly. You'd gather up on either side of the river or the valley where the battle was going to take place. You'd put your flags up, and then you'd make your pot of tea for the night. And you'd sit down, and you'd all, you know, go into the tents, and you'd cook the evening meal. And everyone knew, it was sort of like a sort of, you know, there was an unwritten rule that the battle started tomorrow morning. So everyone knew that. So you sort of settle into your camps and went about the normal activities of the night, because it was tomorrow morning that everything would start in earnest. Well, that night, this horrendously thick, foggy mist came up across the whole field of battle. Now, mists aren't helpful in battle. When you're charging into the face of the enemy but you can't see them because the fog's so thick it's like a pea soup, it's difficult to know, you know, who you're attacking, whether you've actually got the right people on the end of your blade. And you see, most people would have said, oh, this is a problem, this is not looking good, this is going to be bad for the battle tomorrow. Napoleon said, ah, behind every problem there lurks a hitherto unexpected opportunity. That was Napoleon's dictum, by the way. Behind every problem there is an opportunity in disguise. He said, now what's the benefit of the fog? He said, well, I think the fog does give me a benefit. So what he did is he took his little army, split it in half, and marched half his army round in a huge circle in the black of night through the fog until it was right at the back of the other army. And then in the morning, he gave the command to his troops to attack, and they attacked, and they came forward as if they were madmen, possessed. And they came driving into the face of the other army, and the rest of the other army thought, Napoleon's crazy. He knows he can't win this battle, and yet they're attacking like ferocious men possessed. And the battle began, and all of a sudden they were attacked at the rear, and they were completely bewildered by this unexpected force behind them, and Napoleon routed the enemy on that day. Because the mist was not a problem, it was an opportunity. He won one of his greatest battles. Successful people are solutions driven. So what we've got to do is to learn to practice what they call consequence thinking, which determines the potential future impact or importance on any activity in our life based on what our time perspective is. Now, the interesting thing about time perspective is this, that the wealthiest families in the world have a time perspective of about 50 years. What I mean by that is they think in terms of 50-year cycles. Welfare beneficiaries, how long do you think their time perspective is? 1 week to the next paycheck. Truly, they don't think anything beyond that. They think to the next paycheck. They've got no time perspective beyond that. The wealthiest families think 50 years. And everything they plan is with that focus in mind for 50 years out in the future. That's the difference between the two. Ultimately, it's an enormous difference between the success of the two, because their time perspective is utterly different. So consequence thinking is all about learning to determine what will the impact be of what I do right now on the future. And of course the answer is, well, you can't tell. How can you tell what the consequence will be of anything you do now on your future if you've got no goals? If you've never figured any goals out in life, well, what will the impact be on the future? Well, who knows? If you live in the present and you exist for today, well, then there's not going to be any impact for tomorrow, because for you there is no tomorrow. But for Christadelphians, there should be a tomorrow that we're actively, consciously focusing on and towards, shouldn't there? Aren't we future thinkers? I think so. I even feel so. Perhaps I even know so. So these questions come, as you'll clearly understand, on this next screen, from, in fact, a seminar that's designed to force you to think out into the future. So in that sense, it's biblically unrelated, but you might find it helpful all the same. So I want you to take this seriously. Okay, here's the first question These questions are designed, so in fact you might like to take a fresh sheet of paper. Don't show anybody else, this piece of paper is private to you. But take this seriously, so fresh sheet of paper. This is a piece of paper that you can remove and deal with as you wish later on. But these questions are designed to make you think. So take them from that perspective, even though there might be an overlay of the truth that we want to put on this later on. So here's the first question. What would I do if I suddenly received $10 million in cash? Now, you realise that the idea behind that question is, if $10 million was invested in a bank account, I don't know what the interest rate is over here, but let's say you could earn, what's a reasonable rate over here? 3%? 4%? Could you earn 3%? Okay. Our interest rate at the moment in New Zealand is about sort of 5. So let's take a New Zealand interest rate, shall we? Let's sort of say an average of 2, all right? What's the rate in Canada at the moment? Sorry? Less than 1. All right, well, let's say 2, because 1's actually pretty low right now, because the states particularly are driving their interest rates low because of the cycle they're in. But that's not a long-term batting average for interest rates, even in the US short-term interest rate market. So let's say 2%. If you invested $10 million at 2%, what does that produce in terms of income? Well, $10 million at 10% would be $1 million. So $10 million at 2% must be $200,000. So $200,000 divided by 12 is, $10,000 would be 120. So it's about, $15,000? A little bit more than that per month. Net in your hand. So the question is, if you had $200,000 net in your hand, could you live on that? Could you live on $200,000? I just want to make sure that I'm not missing anyone here. Okay, good. So the idea behind this question is that if you just put this money in the bank and do nothing with it but allow it to earn interest, that just the income alone will sustain you in a lifestyle that's perfectly adequate or sufficient. In fact, there's been some interesting studies done on human happiness. And what they discovered was that human happiness is largely correlated to income up to a certain point. And the moment income reaches a level where there's enough food on the table and enough clothes in the wardrobe and the car's okay and the washing machine's good, that in fact, beyond that, the income rises but the happiness quotient doesn't. The happiness quotient goes like that, even though the income goes. In fact, sometimes the happiness quotient goes down as the income rises, because in fact, the more income you earn, the more you feel dissatisfied and the greater the problems start to emerge in terms of managing all of this. But up to a certain point, income and happiness are correlated. And I think that's true, incidentally, even for Christadelphians, because we've still got to live. We've still got to pay the power bills. We've still got to run the car. There's still economic realities that we face, you see. But the moment you reach that level, and that's the idea behind this $10 million, there's enough money in the bank that you actually don't need to do anything ever again in terms of income. It's there for life. Now, the question is, how would that change your life? What would you do? What would you think of doing if that income was there right now in your bank account? So now, just take one moment to write down on a piece of paper. Would it change your life in any way? Because some people say, oh no, I'd love to, well, I've got a job that I love doing, and I don't think I'd actually stop doing the job. Other people would say, oh, if I had that, I'd stop everything I'm doing immediately, and I'd do all these other things in my life and in the truth, because that would allow me the freedom to do those things that I've always wanted to do. Someone might say, if I had that money in a bank account, I'd be off preaching in the mission fields just as quick as a flash, because I could do it. I've always wanted to do it, but I've never had the money that allows me to do that. Now I'd be free to do that, or free to do something else in the truth. What would it be? Would it change your life in any way? Because I think even for Christadelphians, having enough income and more than enough might make you think, well, yes, there's some things I'd love to do if I was free to do that, economically free. So that's the first question. All right, you ready for the next one? Well, the next one's quite interesting, because the next one says, that you go to your doctor one day and the doctor says, I've got some rather bad news for you. You've got a strange heart condition. It's sort of like an aortic aneurysm, but not quite the same. But the net effect is similar, is that at a particular moment in time, your heart's going to burst. The really bad thing about it is it's completely inoperable. There's nothing we can do to change this condition. But the strange thing is that because your heart's expanded as it reaches this condition, the funny thing is you'll feel absolutely terrific in the meantime. You'll feel like you're bursting with energy and good health, but on a certain day, and I can't tell you when it is, but on a certain day, you'll just drop dead. There'll be no pain, it'll be instant, you'll be gone. And by the way, unfortunately, what I have to tell you is, you've got about 6 months. So now the question is, you can keep the $10 million, by the way. But now the question is, so you've still got the income, but now you've only got 6 months to live. Now tell me, what would you do? And would it change what you said to question one? Would it alter your focus now? If suddenly life shrank to just 6 months, how would you feel about that? Would it change your perspective on what you would prioritise for that 6 months compared to what you might have said for question one? Well, here's the third question. See if you can write this down. What do I really love to do that gives me pleasure and satisfaction? What thing do you do that at that moment of time you feel, this is me at my best. This is all my talents at work. When I do this thing, I feel a sense of fulfillment and satisfaction like I never feel in any other way. That somehow this is the outworking of everything that I was gifted with. Do you know what that is? Could you write that down? Now, this next one, I have to say, and I say this for the benefit of the tape really, is doctrinally unsound. But it's purely an analogy. And the analogy is this, that, and you may have heard this one before, but it's quite interesting, is you're at a funeral and the dearly departed is in the coffin at the front and all the people are sitting in the rows and people are going up to the front to say something about the person and you're watching at the back and you suddenly realise that they're talking about you and it's actually your funeral, which of course is doctrinally unsound because you couldn't be there at the back of the room. So I just want you to know, I do realise that. But the question is that they're all saying something about you. And the question is, well, what would you want people to say as a eulogy at your funeral of what this person was really all about? Of course, the reality is that you will be gone, so you're not going to hear what they say. But the question is, what would they say? And what would you want them to say, more importantly? What would you want them to say about who you were as a person? About what you really stood for? About what you really contributed? About how you touched and changed and affected other people? What would you want them to say? If you could just stop for a moment and imagine that you were there. How would you like them to describe you? The essence of who you were. Could you write that down as an idea? In one particular exercise that's done with this, people are asked to write down what their wife would say about them, what one of their children would say about them, what a fellow workmate would say about them, what a neighbour would say about them, and what a chance acquaintance would say about them, to get a range of different people's views on who you really were, and then having gone through that exercise to then say, do you feel comfortable about what they would be probably saying about you? And if you don't like what they were going to say about you, because you had to be absolutely brutally honest with what you thought they would say, to then say, well, what do you need to do to change what you need to do so that they might say something differently? So here's the next one. What one great thing would I dare to dream if I knew I could not fail? If I dreamed of doing one thing, knowing that I'm guaranteed to be successful, what would that be? The one thing in your life that you dare to do? Now remember, this is private. I'm not asking to ever know this. In fact, you probably shouldn't share it either. This is for you alone. But it's got to be honest, you see. It's to make you think. What would that one thing be? Here's the next one. What are the top 7 goals in all major areas of my life? Let me just help you with that, because in my computer, which we won't go into now, but in my computer and in my work schedule, I have my life categorised in 7 key categories, and they are as follows. Just trying to think if I can remember them all. Financial, commercial, which is to do with business. Communal, ecclesial. Family and relationships. Spiritual. Physical and nutritional. And I'm trying to think of the other ones. It's disgraceful. I've got one that's called, which I won't go into, it's called Purple and Inspirational. I've got one called... I'll come back to this later on, because I will actually find this on my calendar a little bit later on. But I've got 7... So that might help you in terms of the sort of key things that you're thinking about. So physical, financial, personal, spiritual, family and relationships. These are the sorts of areas of your life that typically you'd be thinking about in this particular part of the question. So the thing is, have you got any goals in any of those areas of your life? In any of those areas, have you got any goals? Now, imagine that you can't think about that. Let's narrow that down. Which of these are the 3 most important goals in your life right now? In fact, let me test you on that. You ready? So stop for a minute. This is called the 30-second rule. So what I want you to do is to write down on the same piece of paper, on the next bit, starting from when I say, I want you to write down what you think are 3 major goals that you do have in your life right now, starting from now. You've got 30 seconds. 30 seconds. 3 goals in your life, in any aspect, any area, 3 key goals. 20 seconds left. 15 seconds left. 3 goals. Just 3 in any area. 10 seconds left. Down to 5. Did I say 5? Your time has just gone. Now stop. So first of all, hands up those that got 3 goals down. Okay, that's really good, by the way. Now, let me tell you something interesting about that, because this is a known technique. It's called the 30-second forcing rule. And what the 30-second forcing rule is all about is that when the brain is forced to think about that for 30 seconds, what you will probably have written down are the same 3 goals that you still would have written down if you took 3 hours or 3 days or 3 weeks. That's true. That somehow what it does is it puts the brain into overdrive and it goes whoosh, and out it comes. It somehow forces it out, the 30-second rule. So you'll probably find that they're pretty accurate. Those things that you've written down are probably pretty accurate. And by the way, I'm really impressed that you could all write down 3 goals. And most people, if they were to say, well, what were those goals about? Did any of you have a goal that related to health? Did any of you have a goal that related to family and relationships? Did any of you have a goal that related to spiritual things? That's very surprising. Okay, now here's the big question. You may not have ever thought about this before, What's the one goal that will have the greatest effect on progressing all the others? Now that's a good thought. What's the one goal in your life that will have the greatest effect on progressing all the others? Now the question is, number one, have you figured out what that is? And number two, what are you doing about advancing that goal every day of your life? Because if you're not, you're living in the present. And you're existing but not developing. Right, now I'm going to put that off and I want to just tell you a little story. Some of you have heard this story before, but I think it's very powerful for a reason that we'll come to on the board. There was a well-known lecturer that gave a demonstration on his table, and it was basically the story of the rocks. So he had a big glass container and he had seven large rocks. And he put the rocks one by one into the container until finally the rocks had filled the container. You couldn't get any more in because the rocks were quite big, but there were seven of them in this glass jar. And he said to his audience, to his class, he said, "Now, is the jar full?" And most of them said, "Yes, it's full." And he said, "So is that true then?" He said, "Well, watch this." So he got down underneath the table and pulled up a bucket like this. And into the jar, he poured a bucket of what turned out to be gravel. And he poured the gravel and shook the jar, and poured the gravel and shook the jar. And of course, what happened was the gravel moved between the rocks, and gradually the gravel worked its way down through the rocks to the bottom. And finally, the whole of the bucket of the gravel was emptied into the jar, which most of the class had said was already full. But now the bucket of gravel was empty. And in the jar. So he put that down. He said to the group, "Now, is the jar full?" And some said, "But less." "Yes." And he said, "Is that right?" Well, he said, "What do you think of this then?" So he leaned down, he brought up another bucket, exactly the same size, and this time it was a bucket of sand. And he poured the sand very carefully into the jar and shook the jar. And of course, the sand being that much finer, not only fell between the rocks, but fell between the gravel, you see, until finally the bucket, the whole bucket, all the bucket had been emptied into the jar, which was already full. But now a whole bucket of sand had disappeared into the jar as well. He put the empty bucket down. He said to the class, "Do you think the jar's full?" And this time they were all figuring it out. They all said, "No." He said, "Excellent answer. What do you think of this then?" He pulls out another bucket, and this time it was a bucket of water. And he slowly poured the water into the jar, until all the water had gone into the jar, and now this time the jar really was full. Full of rocks and full of gravel and full of sand and full of water, three other empty buckets here, and he said, "So here it is." Now he said, "What do you think the lesson of the story is?" And someone said, "Oh, I know what the answer is." He said, "What do you think the answer is?" He said, "The answer is that you can always get something more into the jar than you thought possible. You can always get something more into life than you thought." He said, "That's not the lesson." He said, "The lesson of this experiment is you can't get the rocks in unless you put them in first." Now, the rocks are our goals. Now, here's the lesson. So imagine a typical week on our calendar. If one of our goals concerns spiritual study or meditation, what that's saying is that unless we have a moment of time spread into our calendar of when we're going to do certain things, unless we put those on our calendar first, they will never be done, because life will pour gravel and sand and water to fill every week of our lives without fail, to the very brim. And if you say, "I must do some Bible study this week, I'll do it at some stage," no, you won't. Will you? You know why? Because the rock's not on your schedule. You haven't put it in the jar first. If you want the rocks to be there, you've got to put them in the jar at the start. That's the lesson of the story. It's a very powerful idea, isn't it, when you think about it? Because life is full of sand and gravel and water. And it will. It'll fill up. Every week will fill up. And somehow what happens is week after week and year after year of our lives go past and we're not actually growing spiritually to the degree that we were capable of because we never figured out how to prioritise getting the rocks into the jar first. Every week of our lives, that's what we've got to do. So I think there's a powerful lesson here, you see, that we can apply even in a spiritual context. So let me move on from that then in terms of some further comments about goals. First of all, there's three quotations. Now, these quotations are from external sources, but then I'm going to give you a couple from the truth itself, which I think are highly relevant. I love this one. If you have no goals of your own, you're doomed to spend the rest of your life fulfilling someone else's. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? So that happens by default. People work in businesses and spend all their life fulfilling the boss's goals. It is possible to work in a job and have goals of your own as well. But if you haven't got any, you'll spend the rest of your life fulfilling his or hers. So even in the truth, we've got to think, well, how might that apply, at least in our life, that we don't want to get to that default position where somehow we're so unclear about our goals that, well, we're not achieving them because we didn't have them. Vision without action is a daydream, but action without vision is a nightmare. And that's quite good too, isn't it? So we've got to have both, you see. We've got to have a vision of where we're heading, but there's no point having vision without actually having some proper goals that we then start actively moving towards. Got to be clear what they are, and then you've got to have an action plan in terms of moving towards the accomplishment of those goals. Either without the other is not a good idea. A whole lot of action without a vision is a nightmare. A whole lot of vision without any action is nothing but a daydream. You may have heard of this study. There's some sort of argument about whether it was a study done at Harvard University or a study done at Yale, and I believe it was done at Harvard. They took a whole graduating class from Harvard. Have I said something funny here? What have I said that's funny? Harvard. No, I'm sorry, Harvard. Harvard. It's Harvard. Harvard? It was done at Yale. They took a whole graduating class, anyway, from this university, one of the great American universities, that shall remain nameless. Now, think about it. They were all graduates from the class, so they were bright, right? They were bright men and women that came out of this class. And they asked them whether they had any goals. And some did and some didn't. But the interesting thing is that they went back 20 years later, they tracked that whole graduating class down, and they assessed their financial status. Now, the interesting thing was, concerning the graduating group, was that 90% of the class had no particular goals when they graduated as to what they hoped to achieve in life. They were happy to have graduated. They were smart. But 90% of the class had no goals. Seven percent had goals that they could verbalize. 3% had goals that were written down. 90% none, 7% verbal, 3% written. 20 years later, when they went back and assessed the financial status of that graduating class, who were probably all about as bright as each other, they found that the 90% that had no goals were mostly existing from paycheck to paycheck, despite their qualifications. The 7% who had verbal goals were financially comfortable. And that 7% that were financially comfortable earned on average twice as much as the 90% that had no goals. The 3% who had written goals were wealthy, and on average they earned 10 times as much per year as the 90% of their same graduating class. Same class. So that's interesting, isn't it? The really interesting bit was when they added up their net worth. And when they added up the wealth of the class, they found that the top 3% that had written goals, do you know what their combined worth was? It was more than the other 97% put together. 3% of the class were worth more than the whole 97% of the rest of the class, all combined together. Same graduating class 20 years before. The only difference was clear goals written down. There's something powerful about this. I think this works even for Christadelphians. You've got to think about this. Here's another quotation, which I really like, because it's actually based on this. Here's the quotation. It's from Stephen Covey. The key is not to prioritise what's on the schedule, but to schedule your priorities. It can be, I think that's a really powerful idea. So the key is not to prioritise what's on the schedule, but to schedule your priorities. Do you say schedule over here? Okay. You can say schedule in the English language, you know, like you can say Harvard if you come from New Zealand. So don't you think that's a powerful point? Because that's what this is about. It's not about prioritising what's on your list of things to do. It's to make sure that the priorities are already on the list at the start. You put the rocks in first. That's how you start to move goals ahead. That's how you start to get focus in life. And what I'm saying is, I think this even applies to sisters and to mothers. Now, there's still lots of things that have got to be done in life, but my point is that somewhere in the midst of all this, there's nothing wrong with brothers and sisters having personal spiritual goals, perhaps even other goals in their life, as they seek to move towards the kingdom. We're future-focused, remember. Here's a couple of quotations from Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts. And as you read these quotations, I want you to ask this question of yourself. Do you think these two brothers had goals? Now read the quotations. Brother Thomas. When someone is deeply and continuously engaged in an atmosphere of divine thoughts, they have neither the time nor inclination to plot mischief or play the fool. This is the vocation of vacant minds and idle hands who know not what it is to enter within the veil. It is essential to contentment, if not to happiness, to be engaged in something for oneself or for an object dearer than self. Do you think Brother Thomas had goals? Oh, yes, I think so. Do you think he was future-focused? Oh, yes, I think so. He didn't say it in those words because they're modern, aren't they? Goal-setting. But that's what he had. He had clear objectives as to where he was going in the truth and what he wanted to accomplish in Christ's service. What about this one from Robert Roberts? Oh, this, I love this one. Nothing useful was ever done without a towering resolution that went far in purpose and desire, beyond that which it was possible to accomplish. Think Robert Roberts had goals? Let me tell you something interesting about a display that we put on at one of our Bible schools in New Zealand. We started with a table, just imagine here, a room about this size probably. So imagine a table starting here that went down to the end, along there, along the back there, and then back to here. So like tables put out, just like yours here. And then on this table here, we started with the very first thing that Brother Thomas ever wrote and published, and the year on a little slip of paper. And then we put the next thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing. Every book, every publication that Brother Thomas ever issued, and then at a certain point as you come around the table, Brother Roberts started. And then we've had Brother Roberts' works. So when Nazareth Revisited was published, it would be there with the tag on the date, 1896, 1897, 1899. And as you came around the table, this whole room was filled with the writings of just those two men. And yet these two men lectured and exhorted and gave Bible classes and travelled all over the ecclesial world and solved ecclesial problems and met with ABs and did all sorts of stuff besides just these books that were sitting on the table. And yet this cascade of spiritual writing was lying out on the table beyond what any of us will ever accomplish, beyond what all of us in this room will ever accomplish. Combined, two single brothers, but they had goals. That's what I believe. And what they accomplished was so far in excess of what we do today that really our spiritual efforts are pathetic in comparison. We've got to be much more focused about the truth, don't you think? Much more serious about our intention as to where we're going so that we make a contribution to the growth of the truth as not just a mother and not just a wife, but as a sister in the ecclesia with responsibilities as a sister. How are you going to contribute? What are your goals in that direction? So one of the things I wanted to mention was, I said earlier on that I really like the idea of having a Bible person that you can look up to as a source of inspiration. Now, I know that for all of us, Christ has got to be the source of inspiration. But perhaps even more so for sisters than for brothers, to have a heroine in the Bible of a sister that you admire is, I think, a really good thing to do and also a really good study to engage in. That you felt as if you've drawn close to a sister in the Bible who impresses you, who inspires you, and you seek to emulate them. And the reason why I think that's a good idea is because I think that's what women in the Bible did themselves. And we'll come to that in a minute, you see. I'm going to give you an illustration of that. But here's how I think that story starts. So the first of all, who's your special Bible hero or heroine whose example you admire? I've got three. I won't tell you them all. I'll possibly share one with you tonight. I'll pull the curtains on a couple of my personal things tonight and let you glimpse them for a moment. Because these are private things in a way, aren't they? But I'll share it with you tonight only for the reason so that you can see who I chose, why I chose them, and what it means to me in terms of how I conduct my life because of that hero. So the next question is, well, why does this particular character inspire you? What is it about this person in the Bible that really draws you to them? And I think there are characters like this that we just somehow just think, oh. It's sort of like the person most of all you want to meet in the kingdom, say hello to. Who is that person and why do they inspire you? The next question is, So what role, consistent with his example, do you wish to fulfil in the kingdom? You know, I think this is something that Christadelphians aren't very good at. You know, for many Christadelphians, the kingdom is a sort of a lovely time of generality we're all sure it's going to be nice, but none of us have got a clue what we're actually going to do. Well, don't you know what you're going to do in the kingdom? See, I think you should. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not being arrogant here. It's of the Father's mercy that we're in the kingdom. We're not saying that we deserve to be in the kingdom or that we will belong in the kingdom of our own right, because we won't. None of us will earn the kingdom. But don't you think that we ought to have some clarity of mind as to what we could do in the kingdom to advance the Father's purpose? Don't you think we should have some particular labour or work in mind that we could do in the Father's service? So what is that thing? Have you thought about it? Are you clear on it? What do you want to do in the kingdom? And maybe it's related to this person, you see, that some inspirational aspect of this person's life is what you'd love to do in the kingdom. So what skills will you need to accomplish that task to Yahweh's honour when the kingdom comes? Because it's no good saying, oh, I'd love to be that, but preparing absolutely nothing towards it. Isn't life today about preparing for the kingdom? So what do you want to do in the kingdom, and what skills will you need that you need to prepare for now? So that if God's good grace leads you into the kingdom, that you can say, you can put up your hand and say to the Lord, I'd like to do this, and I'm ready. I've prepared for that very task in my mortal life. I was focused on that. What steps are you taking now to develop those special abilities for future service? It's almost like a job description, really. Imagine writing a job description for a particular job in the kingdom. And then saying, oh, well, I probably don't qualify for that at the moment, but I could if I worked hard. Well, maybe that's a good idea. Write the job description down, then start working towards becoming qualified. I mean this in the best sense of the word. And lastly, in that context, what would be the most valuable use of my time right now in terms of advancing that goal? All based on my Bible hero or heroine, but preparatory for a particular thing in the kingdom that I would love to do, God willing, if God graciously permits me a place. Because we don't just all want to amble into the kingdom and hope that we might be able to do something. That's not very focused, is it? I think our journey to the kingdom should be much more deliberate than that. And every sister needs to have clarity on that process, I think, in their lives. So here's an example by way of illustration. Now, this is a biblical one. If you come back to the book of Judges, do you remember there was a famous woman in Judges? Whose name was the bee. So, in Judges chapter 4, we're told in verse 4, and Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time, and she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel and Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came to her for judgment. And she sent and called Barak the son of Abinoam out of Kedesh Naphtali and said unto him. So here we've got an introduction to the story of Deborah, the prophetess, and a judge. She judged Israel at that time. She must have been a remarkable woman, mustn't she? Now, you just imagine this woman. The whole of Israel is so apostate that there are no leaders. Even Barak, she's got to try and get him moving, doesn't she? She's got to encourage him, push him into taking some leadership role in the battle that transpires. But it was her faith and her courage and her victory that inspired the nation, and her song of praise that follows afterwards. Deborah, who dwells under her own palm tree, and the children of Israel came to her for judgment. Now, if you were a woman like Deborah, where would you go to for a source of inspiration? Who could Deborah have possibly chosen as her role model? What woman of the Bible would she look to for inspiration? She's a prophetess and she's the leader of the nation. There's not too many women she can probably look to, is there? But I think she found one in her Bible studies. She found a sister that she could look up to and be inspired by, you see. Now, would you like to see who that was? Well, let me show you the connections first of all. I think she modelled herself on Miriam. When you actually read the record, you'll find that they were both prophetesses who saw wider issues in the overthrow of the enemy that came against them. They both faced an enemy that was mighty in horses and chariots. We're told that expressly in Exodus 14 and Judges chapter 4. The enemy desired to make spoil of Israel on both occasions in Exodus 15 and Judges chapter 5. We're told that. They were both sent before the nation for deliverance. It says that expressly of Miriam in Micah 6. And the same of Deborah in Judges 5. They both witnessed a victory by the onrush of water. Exodus chapter 14 verse 27. Judges 5 verse 21. Victory came by water. And they both sang the song of praise to God for the nation's deliverance when the story was over. Oh yes, I think that Deborah found a Bible heroine to emulate. Well, now how did I do that, by the way? How do you think I figured that out? How many Hebrew words did I look up, do you think? Or was it just careful Bible reading? So how would I have done that, by the way? Tell me how I would have done that. Well, I would have started with by reading the story of Deborah, don't you think? And as I read the story of Deborah, what I would have probably said is, can I see any echoes here to another story or another time or another place or another person? And because I've done enough Bible reading, I caught echoes. And suddenly, when you see it, you see it. And all of a sudden, it's there. So there's a whole cascade of connections, you see, which leads me to the conclusion that Deborah had a heroine that she had both chosen and then emulated in the Bible record. Someone to inspire her. Wasn't that marvellous? And now, what's interesting about that is that's all the facts, of course, you see. That's the facts, isn't it? We gathered the facts, got all the biblical evidence to prove it. So what's the principle, and why did she choose this person? Well, I think she chose Miriam for the reason that I suggested, and that's this. That you see, who could she have? Who could Deborah really choose? She was a prophetess, that was very unusual, and she was the spiritual leader of the nation, which was absolutely unique. She looked up to the one woman who matched her experience in the nation. There was no one else, was there? When you stop and think about it, previous to Deborah, who was there that matched her experience apart from Miriam? But she found her, you see. And I think she studied the life of Miriam. She was inspired by that woman. In Miriam's day, there were faithful men that led the congregation. In Deborah's day, there were none. Even Barak had to be urged to his role. And yet perhaps Deborah remembered that Miriam had been unwise in the matter of trying to supplant Moses, or talking about Zipporah, Moses' wife. And so she never sought to supplant Barak in the story of the battle of Judges 5. And I wonder whether, when that victory was all done, I wonder whether Deborah saw the deliverance of the nation from Sisera as not only a repetition of Israel's deliverance from Pharaoh, but that just as Israel stood on the other bank after the defeat of Egypt to start life afresh, I wonder whether Deborah saw in the overthrow of Sisera that here at last was a chance for the nation to begin again before God in their spiritual growth. Oh yes, I think she saw all of that. She entered into that. She captured the whole story of Miriam in her studies, you see. She had a Bible heroine. Now to me, it's just one good example. I think there's quite a few examples of sisters that did this in the Bible. The question is, who's yours? Have you found that person so that you might emulate them? Well, actually, I was going to say a few other things, but I think my time has gone for this particular session. So what we might do is take another break so you can get up, stretch, take a breath of fresh air, have a glass of crisp cold water. Yes? You want to go back? Okay. Is that what that meant? Here we are, back. Oh, you mean back. Right. So I suppose the point of this exercise And I have deliberately tried to push you in your thinking, is to say, could I go home and write down some clear spiritual goals about where I'm heading in the truth and what I might even want to do in the kingdom, which incidentally helps to clothe the kingdom with reality, makes the kingdom very close and very real and very special if you've got a role that you'd love to perform, God willing, but you've got to prepare for it now. See, that's my point. You need goals towards that. But the wonderful thing about that is, if you've got those goals, which turn into the rocks on the calendar, all of a sudden, you're living in the future and your life starts to develop more rapidly, spiritually, than it will have if you don't have those goals. Here endeth the lesson.